We welcome all of you to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases on our 9 o'clock docket. We appreciate your patience in one of those situations. We will go directly from the first case into the second case since all counsel are here and have announced ready. Because of the dividing of the appellant's time between two counsel, in the rebuttal phase, our machinery doesn't really go below the 2 minutes, so I will be using the old-fashioned egg timer during rebuttal, and I will give you a one-minute warning, just so you know. During the opening arguments, though, we will be using our regular lighting system. All right. If the clerk will please announce who's arguing today. All right. Thank you. All right, if we're ready to proceed, Mr. Reimer first. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor, Mr. Martin
first. Okay.
Okay, let me say that we are late this morning because of me, not Judge Gabriel or Judge Livingston, and I apologize for that.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Peter Martin, along with Katie Manning at counsel table. We represent BDD in this case. BDD will rely on Portrait's counsel's argument regarding the statute of limitations, which the court will note that we have adopted pursuant to the rules. First, Your Honors, just a brief summary of the facts as it pertains primarily to BDD. The underlying case was tried in January 24th through February 16th of 2011. The jury found several of the defendants, including BDD, liable for $85,000 in actual damages and $1,005,000 in diminution of value. SecureLock's facility was allegedly sustained those damages as a result of flooding. The jury held my client, BDD, responsible for 25% of the damages. The contracts introduced at the trial were for the rendition of professional services by BDD, engineering services, and set forth the applicable standard of care. The scope of the BDD contract was included, but was not limited to designing a drainage system to meet the city's approval. No project services were included in those contracts. No on-site services were included. The plans were submitted and approved by both the city of Bedford and the TxDOT. No changes were ever made to that design by SecureLock or anyone else, and the flooding problems were eventually resolved. This last fact goes to the statute of limitations, which Mr. Reimer will argue, and that is we believe that it's uncontested that SecureLock knew of flooding in 2006. In fact, July of 2006, they reported flooding on their property, allegedly caused by rainwater runoff from the Durango Ridge development. The final fact, Your Honors, is that no professional negligence instruction was given to the jury in this case, although one was submitted by BDD. That's the factual background that I'd like to give the court. Our legal argument is that the wrong legal standard was instructed and used to determine liability in this case. The Williams case, 2002, Supreme Court case says that a jury charge which does not correctly state the law can be grounds for reversal where, as here, a proper instruction has been submitted and rejected. We believe that the verdict in this case is reversible and should be reversed and probably caused the rendition of an improper judgment because, number one, BDD was entitled to their own negligence instruction as a professional based upon whether or not BDD complied with applicable professional engineering standards. If the jury had been given BDD's submitted professional negligence instruction, the jury would have had to compare BDD's conduct to other civil engineers working under the same standards. If that instruction had been given, the jury would have had to apply all of the evidence introduced in the trial of this matter, all of which dealt with compliance or noncompliance with professional standards. Evidence such as The engineering plans submitted by BDD were approved by the City of Bedford engineers and the TxDOT engineers. Mr. Perkins, the City of Bedford chief engineer, who testified that BDD met the engineering standard of care. Mr. Perkins, based upon reasonable engineering probability that the plans were not defective. The testimony, of course, of BDD itself through its own civil engineer and through its expert. But my point is all of the evidence, even including SecureLock's evidence, was all centered around whether or not the BDD met its professional standard, its standard of care in the industry as an engineer. That's what all the evidence was. The contract I've already mentioned, even the Certificate of Merit statute, which the court's very familiar with, is you can't even bring this lawsuit unless you allege and prove that somebody violated the professional standard of care.
But their argument is that as it was submitted, you were held to a lesser standard of care, and so you weren't harmed.
I understand, Your Honor. The problem with that argument is, first, this is not a criminal case. This is a civil case. There's no such thing in the cases as a lesser standard of care. In fact, the cases, the two cases that I think are on point that the court may want to consider are Atkins, its own case. This is the second, this is a second court of appeals case. Atkins, I want to read you just a little section from Atkins. The standard of care for an accountant, a skilled professional class, is that accountants are subject generally to the same rules of liability for negligence in the practice of their profession as members of other skilled professions. This court didn't say, or in addition to that, ordinary care under some circumstances. This court in Atkins said professionals are held to professional standard of care. Let me go one step further. The Ryan case, which is also cited by IOI, says that is a well-settled rule that in this case an architect must use the skill and care in the performance of his duties commensurate with the requirements of his profession, and that he is only liable in damages if he is negligent in performing such professional duties. All right, so our argument, Your Honor, on lesser standard is there is no other standard for a professional. There's not a, in addition, Your Honors, there was not any evidence put on at this trial as to whether BDD was negligent. It was, all of the evidence was whether or not they failed to abide by the standard of care in their profession. So we would say that the lesser included argument, although one of the cases talks about higher and lower. There's one other interesting point about that, is the PJC, which I understand is not controlling, says whenever you have two standards of care, this is 2.2, 2.3, the comment, whenever you have two standards of care in a case, you should submit them both. The judge should submit them both. So it doesn't say, take the higher standard, take the lower standard of care. It says, submit them both. And we submitted the exact PJC for liability for non-medical professionals. And it's our, in our opinion, that's what the judge should have given in this case. What they did instead was lump everybody in the case together and make it a simple negligence standard.
Are you saying, or does the PJC say, you submit two standards for the same defendant?
No, Your Honor. It says when there are two different standards of care among the parties, you should submit them both. It doesn't say submit the lower one and that'll be good enough, because if they meet the lower one.
Or could it have been done by two separate instructions within the same question?
I believe so, Your Honor. Okay. What we're really talking about is separate instructions. Ordinary care and negligence should have had the word engineer compared with an engineer. And that's what we've got here. We've got a jury that listens for a long period of time as to evidence That's all on professional engineering, pleadings that are that way. The certificate of merit is that way. The trial is held that way. And the judge takes all nine parties, puts them in the same simple negligence question.
All right. I believe your time is up. All right. And now we go to Mr. Reimer, I believe. And you'll have 10 minutes. And you'll get a two-minute warning.
May it please the court, given the very limited time, I'm going to jump directly into just a couple of facts. The important facts for my client for purposes of this are that Portrait Homes was the developer of this project. They didn't do any of the design. They didn't do any of the construction. They hired all that out. They hired professionals to design the storm drainage system. They hired professionals to build the storm drainage system. All of that was approved by the city. Everything was approved. My client was just the developer. It's also important to understand that there's no dispute in this case that the July 5th, 2006 event happened. The plaintiffs were aware it happened, and they were aware that, in fact, it related to the Durango Ridge development. And there's emails in evidence that show that. So those issues are really not in dispute. And I'm going to jump directly into the waiver argument that was made by SecureLock very late in a SIR reply brief. They made a waiver argument as to the statute of limitations submission. And just very briefly, this court need look no further than Hollebeck versus Brandenburg, which is a Texas Supreme Court case from 2003. And in this case, we have a specific objection that was overruled, and that's all that's required. The rules of civil procedure say, 274 says, that when it is an improper submission, not a missing submission, all you have to do is object. You don't have to submit your own question. However, we did that not one time, but we did it three times. We submitted a charge that included that submission. But if you look at Hollebeck, Hollebeck was a very similar case. It was a case involving the statute of limitations. It was a one-year statute in that case. And this was the objection at the charge conference. We object specifically as to the date of December 31, 1986. That was the entirety of the objection. They then submit their own proposed question, and the Texas Supreme Court found it was wrong. It wasn't even the right question. But the Texas Supreme Court said that's not the issue. It's clear they objected. There was an overruling of the objection. It wasn't clear. It was very broad. But it was clear the trial court understood the issue of the statute of limitations because of a summary judgment motion filed a year prior to trial. And that's what they relied on. Here we have way more than that. We have the specific objection, and I'll direct the court directly to the record at 11 RR11. The specific objection is we also object to the question as to the date for the statute of limitations, question number 11. We believe that the date should include July 2006 as a date whenever SecureLock knew or should have known about the condition causing its damages. What that's doing is that's saying we object that date needs to be in there and it needs to be tied to the condition causing it, not what caused it, not the specific cause. In other words, they were aware they got flooded and there was some relationship to Durango Ridge, not the specific cause. And that's the technical argument the plaintiffs are going to make, is that there were these things that they had no idea about going on at Durango Ridge that changed, and that somehow saves them from the statute of limitation. But we'll get to that in a minute. But just as important, if you look at the record at 10 RR230, you see this was the motion for the plaintiff's motion for directed verdict. At the end of all the evidence, at the close of the evidence, the plaintiff moved for directed verdict on the statute of limitations. And the defendant specifically at that time told the court this. And they set out the exact submission that they want. They say, the one that we have submitted, on what date do you find that SecureLock of Bedford was aware or should have been aware that flooding had occurred at its storage facility in Bedford? It's not required that there be specific causes identified, but the fact that they should have been aware that flooding was occurring as a result of something going on at SecureLock, that was the day. July 5th was the day. Then the court goes on to say, a couple of pages later, the court specifically says, all right, and this is at page 232, all right, I'm going to deny the motion for directed verdict on the statute of limitations issue. I'm probably not going to submit the question quite as broadly as you all, the defendants, have it, but I'm going to deny the motion. It's clear, under the standards set out in Hollebeck, the issue is, did the court understand the issue? The court says on the record it understood the issue, and it was going to take the plaintiff's submission. In addition, just like the case in Hollebeck, there was a motion for summary judgment filed. On three separate occasions, the defendant filed its proposed jury charge. So the court had all of that in addition to a specific objection and an overruling of that objection on the record. So this, when you start with Hollaback, there is way more preservation here than Hollaback. There's another series of cases. I'm not going to go into all of those given the shortness of time, but there's a series of cases where they find that a jury charge filed earlier in the case was sufficient to preserve area. The issue is just, was the court aware that there was an issue? And the court itself says it was aware right on the record. It knew what the issue was. It had been raised over and over and over in the trial. All right, so turning now directly to the statute of limitations argument, there's no dispute that the first of 14 flooding events occurred on July 5th, 2006. If you look at the evidence, the owner of SecureLock, Andrew Smith, testified as follows. When were you aware that there was flooding that you attributed to water coming down, at least in part, Durango Ridge Drive?
Hey, let me ask this question. Let's suppose that the first flood was for the reason that they allege, and then you fixed it. Then two or three years go by, and then the first of the other 13 floods begin. Under your argument, they couldn't ever bring a case because they were aware of flooding, and you fixed it to fix the reason for the flooding, and then more than the statute of limitation goes by.
Yeah. Your Honor,
that can't possibly make any sense.
Your Honor, Snyder National versus Bates specifically addresses this issue, and that's the Texas Supreme Court in 2004 case. And what they did, they said in that case that there are really three factors you've got to show, and that's a substantial change doctrine is what they're arguing. And that comes, what they're arguing comes from a case called Atlas Chemical versus Anderson. It's a Texas Supreme Court case in 1976. And let me give you the basic facts, because this is the only case that's ever held this way. All right, and what that case said is, for 40 years, this chemical plant had been putting out minor effluent that had been flowing downstream and flooding about 4 acres or polluting about 4 acres around the stream of a guy's property. After 40 years, they add lime to the mix. And suddenly, instead of this minor pollutant, it just deluges down the waterway and now floods 60 acres. So 12 times the amount of acreage. In addition to it being just a little pollutant right around the waterway, it was 10 to 12 inches deep at points. So there you had completely different facts. And the court in that case did agree, Justice McCoy. It said you can't excuse a later nuisance by an earlier nuisance. So you can't get away with it. But Snyder comes back and says, okay, that's limited to its facts. Here are the three things you've got to show for that to apply, for a substantial change to occur. You have to have a different injury, and in that case it was the increased effluent caused by the lime. You have to have new property affected. In this case it was 56 more acres or more than 12 times, and you have to have new forces. In this case, all the plaintiff, if true, and it's certainly disputed about whether it's even true, but if true, they can only point to the third of those factors, which is a new force. Something different in Durango Ridge. And they understand they didn't know at the time. This is all what engineers determined during the course of the lawsuit. But the point is, something changed over the course of about 6 months. That's their position. But the exact same property is affected. It's building A and C, and the exact same number of units. The damage is exactly the same as water damage. The only difference, arguably, is a difference in the new force. Now, Snyder addresses that specifically. And Snyder says that the only, let's see, the reality, the Snyder court says that, made it clear that the plaintiff, I'm missing it. Anyway, Snyder says, and I can't find it specifically, oh yeah, Snyder at 292 makes clear that changing causes at the source, which is what the plaintiffs allege here, are only relevant to the analysis if it changes the injury. Here we have an absolutely identical injury, therefore that's irrelevant.
Let's go back to my question to you was, okay, they allege the reason, you fix it. What are they supposed to do? Because the other cause of the next flooding hasn't occurred yet. What are they supposed to do? Nothing?
Well, no, they could have filed suit. And Your Honor, keep in mind, the next flood is only about 5.5 months later. It's in December. They have a second flood. They could have filed suit there. They still have 18 months left on the statute of limitations. And let me direct this court to the case of Pope versus John Colleen Holmes out of Amarillo. It's a 2008 case. There were only two floods. There were one flood, and then 2.5 years go by in a second flood, and the plaintiff then goes, wait, we may have a problem. Exactly what you're talking about. He files suit. The court in that case said, no, it was a permanent injury. The statute of limitations began to run on the first flood. There, it's a very harsh result, because the second flood didn't happen until after the statute of limitations ran. Here, when the second flood occurs, we're only in December. We're 5 months later. The plaintiff still has 18 months to file suit. They get a series of additional floods. They don't file suit. They wait until after the statute of limitations. Schneider is directly on point on that issue, and I think Schneider controls this case, and it's very specific. It says that this argument they're making changes at the source, and if this court looks directly at that, you can read it right out of Schneider. Changes at the source only matter if it results in a different injury. And here we have the identical injury to the exact same property. Moving quickly to the water code violations, there has never been a water code violation case sustained where the cause of the water was a system put in place specifically to lessen water impact. All of the cases where they've upheld the water code has been a situation where the defendant has built a berm to basically just wash water over onto the plaintiff's property. And specifically, if you look at the Mitchell versus Blomdale case out of Austin, that was almost an identical case to here. Mitchell versus Blomdale, they created an erosion system and a drainage system, and that drainage system took in the water, and it ultimately diverted that to the plaintiff. May I briefly conclude, Your Honors?
Yes, just wrap up, please.
Okay. In that case, they had created the system, and the plaintiffs argued, hey, you can't make it not surface water by yourself creating the system that takes it into pipes and ditches. And the court in that case reversed a jury trial just like we have here, and they said no, doesn't matter who reduces the water into pipes and ditches and controls it. Once it's controlled, any flooding that results is not a water code violation. For these reasons, we ask that the court overturn the trial court and remand, or reverse and render if they find that statute of limitations applies.
All right, thank you, Mr. Reimer. All right, now we have Mr. Moses for our appellees.
May it please the court, counsel, in light of the limited time allowed for oral argument and my familiarity with this court, knowing you've read all the briefs, SecureLock's going to direct its argument toward why the judgment should remain intact rather than why its cross points are valid. And it does so for a very practical reason. Portrait Home's current status in bankruptcy is such that even if you reverse and remand on the breach of contract case, our claim, and the gross negligence claim, SecureLock's likelihood of recovering is limited, so I don't want to use a lot of my time discussing something that really gets us little. Appellant's points of errors related to SecureLock's claims of nuisance, negligence, and violations of the water code can easily be negated, and Justices McCoy and Gabriel, your questions seem to suggest you've picked up why those questions can easily be negated and what the real question is. The gravamen of this case is whether it's barred by limitations. And unless it's barred by limitations, the jury's verdict, which exceeds $1.7 million, must remain intact. A close review of the applicable law, along with the evidence that was submitted, confirms that this case is not barred by limitations and that each of the other points of error are invalid. With respect to Portrait Homes appellants, and I'll put them in one bulk and the Brockett Davis appellant in the other bulk, the water code violation is clear, and the trespass violation is clear. SecureLock concedes the trespass issue as to Brockett Davis is the most tenuous, because the cases do seem to suggest it's not just an interference and an intent to cause the conduct that created the interference. It's a true intent to cause the interference. And with respect to Brockett Davis, it's less clear whether that existed. With respect to the Portrait Homes appellants, it's clear it existed. And we've cited cases that suggest once you're put on notice of a problem and you fail to rectify that problem, that raises to the level of intent to what is necessary for a trespass case. Now let's go to the heart of the case, the statute of limitations issue. Unless this court finds that the original July event is related to the December 06 and subsequent 12 flood events, this verdict must remain intact. And if you read appellant's briefs, they've taken snippets of the record and deleted very significant portions of the record which confirm limitations was not met by them. It's their burden. That's the first thing that has to be remembered. It was the appellant's burden to prove the claim was barred. Much was made of the case of Schneider versus Bates, and a close review of that case confirms that the verdict is appropriate. First, you have a substantial change in condition. Justice McCoy, you asked, what happens if that first flood is truly caused by the inlets being covered? Whether or not there was a factual dispute, the jury found that that first flood was caused by the inlets being covered. You can look at me and ask, well, Mr. Moses, how do you know that the way the issue was submitted? Because look at the actual issue that was submitted. It's not what's been represented to you by appellants in their briefing. The actual issue was, what was this event? And I'll just quote, the flooding of its storage facilities, in other words, this event, caused by the acts or omissions of any of the defendants that serve as the basis of this lawsuit. If the acts or omissions were the same with respect to the summer flood as the December flood, then the answer that would have been written there is the summer date, and the case would have been barred by limitations. It wasn't. How do we know it wasn't? And Justice McCoy, directing my argument to your specific question, we gave two analogies in our briefing. One related to an auto repair circumstance. If I take my vehicle in and it's got brake problems and an engine problem, so I can't start it, and that particular mechanic warrants his work or her work for 30 days. I pick up my car and it still doesn't start. So they say, give me more time to fix it. 29 days later, they get it to work. I drive off, my brakes work fine. The very next day, which is now exceeding the original 30-day period, my brakes stop working. Well, under appellant's position, I have no claim. But I also didn't have an opportunity to determine whether or not the brakes worked. The other example we provided was, what if Portrait Homes turned on one of the fire hydrants on its premises and shot water toward us? And then they turned it off, we stopped flooding. Obviously, if the subsequent drainage system didn't work, we'd still have a claim. And that's no different than covering the inlets. Now,
but you didn't file suit for damages from the July 2006 lawsuit. And so I have not read the complete record, but I'm assuming that there's no evidence concerning damages that you were seeking from the 2006 flood. So the way the question's phrased, if the jury had said the earlier flood, there would have been no evidence to support that because that wasn't the basis of your lawsuit.
There was evidence because if it was...
But you weren't claiming damages from the first flooding event, correct?
We were not, and we could not have claimed the diminution in value damages, which is also significant. If we had filed this claim after the first flood, Brockett Davis would have been entitled to a summary judgment because their system had not yet been put
okay,
in place.
Okay, but let's get to my question, and that is the way this question is phrased, the jury had no choice but to put in the date that you wanted because that was the first date of the first flood that you were filing your lawsuit about.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree because it's not just, it doesn't just say what damages. It says that serves as the acts or events that serve as the basis of the suit. It doesn't say the damages.
Okay, but you weren't suing for the first flood. So it wasn't part of the basis of your lawsuit, was it?
It was not a claim for the damages. It is, if it was the same event, they could have filled in the same date. And in fact, the questions they submitted, there was no dispute that the only date that could have been filled in was the July date. In fact, as appellants argued, we didn't disagree that there was flooding that occurred on the July date. And so there was no reason to submit the questions. The cases are clear that first, the Holland versus Loveless case, a 2011 case, says that it's the burden on the appellants to find the date of accrual in order to support their defense. The questions they asked, the specific questions they submitted, if they submitted them, and again, it's unclear, but it does appear that the court had a question in front of it and knew what those questions were. The question the Portrait Home submitted was, on July of 2006, was SecureLock at Bedford LTD either aware of or should it have been aware of the flooding that occurred? Well, the only answer you can put to that is yes.
Okay, but even if their question was wrong, I get back to, as this question is phrased, that the date, that's the only answer that could be given, because if the jury had filled in July of 2006, you would have been able to appeal that there's no evidence to support that, because that didn't serve as a basis for your lawsuit.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree again, because you've got to look at what the court asked. It didn't ask damages. It said the acts are admissions, and it would have been the same acts or admissions that were the basis of this lawsuit. So, for instance, had the system been put in place and tested, which the case law makes clear you're entitled to test the system when you've got a new construction issue, had it been put in place and tested, then they could have, and they did argue, that that's the same act or omission that serves as the basis of this lawsuit. It doesn't request, it's not tied to damages.
How do you get around Mitchell versus Bartlett?
Mitchell versus Bartlett's a case I'm extremely familiar with because of who tried it and how it was tried. And there's a very distinct distinction. First of all, Mitchell versus Bartlett has none of the three factors that are discussed in Bates. In other words, substantial change and new injury and et cetera. That was a case you had drilling. There's no question the drilling had occurred years in advance. The only thing that was tied to that question was whether or not they knew who caused the problem. That's not what this question asks, and that's what it's been suggested to you at ask. Their whole suggestion in their briefing is the wrong question was asked because you didn't say when did you or should you have known who to sue. That's what they want it to be, and that was the Mitchell case. That's not this case. This is all tied to acts or admissions, and that was not what was asked in Mitchell. There's a distinct difference in those two cases. The water code violation itself, it borders on being silly, the contention. And Justice Gamage, in his dissenting opinion, probably says it best when he writes that that if you were to agree with appellant's position, you could never have a water code violation because the waters that were channelized, what they claim is, well, we channelized, we put the water into a channel. We then put it into your property. That first channelization takes it out of the water code because it's no longer diffuse surface water. And Justice Gamage points out that where the channelized and diverted water is diverted by hands of the upper estate, and those same hands were the same ones that caused the subsequent flooding to the lower estate, you should have had a water code violation. Now, that's really not what the case turns on anyway, and none of the cases they rely upon turn on whether or not it was touched by the hands of man or whether or not it was channelized. Each of the cases they rely upon turns upon the fact that you've got an upper estate. That upper estate changes the water from its natural flow. The lower estate then builds some sort of dam or berm, which causes that upper estate to flood. The upper estate has no claim under the water code because it's already changed the water and it's no longer surface water. That's not the case here. It's the upper estate that touches the water, directs it toward SecureLock, and causes the flooding. And under those circumstances, there's little issue that a water code violation can occur. And there's actually, the representation was made, there's no cases in which a water code violation is found. That's untrue. We cited you to two of them. The Texas Women's University case and the Marion case, both of which are in our briefs. So there are cases under very similar circumstances in which a water code violation was allowed to stand. The trespass case I addressed briefly in my initial comments, you do have to have an intent. And that intent is very difficult to find as to Brockett Davis, because it didn't continue to do a wrongful act. But that intent as to the portrait defendants is easy to define, because what you had was portrait analyzing the circumstances, making a representation, aha, we've identified a plug or a valve that's going to prevent water from flowing so quickly that was not installed, and we've identified a drainage ditch or a berm that we could build, and we're going to do so. They never did the latter. They did the former, but did so after months and additional flooding had occurred. Now, you're likely to hear in rebuttal, well, you went and took steps to fix it, SecureLock, and therefore you could have fixed it initially. That's not the burden, and that's not the law. SecureLock could have incurred the cost associated with fixing the property. It shouldn't have had to, because it had no duty to accept water from the upper estate other than in the initial condition in which that water flowed. The final points, which you've heard nothing of, are this cumulative error argument. First, you have to have error to have cumulative error, and there was none. The delay in the representations regarding closing argument, I have to say, border on being offensive. First of all, there's many courts within this court circuit that the way they handle their docket, every case is tried in a slower fashion than just Judge Wallace tried this case, even with weather conditions. And so every case, you'd be entitled to a new trial. Secondly, my closing argument exceeded 80 pages in length, and there were 7 lines in which I made a mention of my deceased mother. It wasn't objected to, and it wasn't waived. I realize I've got less than a minute, and Justice Gabriel, I want to address this limitations issue one more time now that I've at least hit everything else. I think it is significant. You said, well, Mr. Moses, the way you've submitted the question, there's no date other than the date you wanted to be included. Well, that's, again, I respectfully disagree, because you have to look at the acts or admissions language. But most significantly, you do have to look at the 2 questions that possibly, and I say possibly because the record isn't clear, were submitted by the appellants. And when you look at those 2 questions, there's no question but that the only date that could have been put was the July date, and that doesn't answer the question. The question isn't, was there a flood in July? The question is that flood causally connected to the subsequent floods, as Justice McCoy pointed out in his initial questioning? Thank you.
I have a follow-up question. You really haven't spoken to the jury charge issue and the failure to split out the professional cause of action versus ordinary negligence.
There's 2 reasons why the issue's a non-issue. First, if you actually read the question, it is split out. The question itself reads, a similarly situated party of ordinary prudence. In other words, you are asked about, with respect to the civil engineer, a civil engineering standard. And that's how it was argued. Second, and I realize it's not a Texas case, it's a, I believe, Missouri case, and I've cited it in the brief, is did it the exact same way. They had multiple professionals and said someone similarly situated in the court said, you are applying them to the right standard. And finally, to address Justice Gabriel's prior question, it is significant. Each of the cases they rely upon that say, well, you can't use this because it's a different standard, it was a situation where either the plaintiff did not prevail because that defendant was given a lower standard, in other words, it was easier to meet and it failed to meet, or the plaintiff did prevail and it was given the wrong standard. It was always the wrong standard was applied that made it more difficult to prove either the defense or the claim. Here, if the wrong standard was applied, and I don't think it was, if you actually read the question, it made it more difficult for plaintiff to recover, easier for defendant to defend against the claim, and therefore there can be no harm, because you do have to show harm. In each of the cases they relied upon, it was harm was shown. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Moses. All right, now we go back to Mr. Martin, I believe, and I will be giving you a 1-minute warning.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, counsel for the plaintiff admits that there's no evidence of trespass on the part of BDD. That was certainly true. I would add that there's also no evidence of nuisance on the part of creation of a nuisance by BDD. I would, in response to his last point, Your Honor, similarly situated party does not mean the same thing as a civil engineer of ordinary prudence. When you instruct on a civil engineer of ordinary prudence, you're asking the jury to compare the conduct of the engineer in question to another civil engineer of ordinary prudence practicing in Tarrant County. Similarly situated party, when you have nine parties, can mean similarly situated to whom? I mean, were the jury supposed to sit there and say, okay, explore this conduct based upon a similarly situated party? Does that mean a similarly situated party working for Portrait, a similarly situated party being sued by SecureLock, a similarly situated party who worked on the Durango Ridge project? Is a developer similarly situated to an engineer? The law is clear that there is only one standard for non-medical professional negligence in Texas, and that is your activities compared to a similarly situated civil engineer, accountant, lawyer. And to disregard that essentially takes away a man's profession and levels the playing field and says, let's just do this based on ordinary care. That's not the law, and there is no support in our law for doing that. Ryan says there's only one standard. The plaintiffs pled a case of professional negligence. The plaintiffs put on a case of professional negligence. The plaintiffs did not submit an issue or an instruction having to do with professional negligence. The plaintiffs are not entitled to a verdict against BDD of simple negligence. There is no simple negligence of a professional in Texas. Any verdict other than one based upon whether BDD satisfied its standard of professional care is erroneous.
All right, your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Reimer. You have 3 minutes total. You'll get a one-minute buzzer.
Three quick points on rebuttal. Justice Gabriel, you hit it right on the head. There's two basic problems with the jury submission on the statute of limitations. The first is it's tied to the cause. It says specifically, if you look, was caused by the acts or omissions of any of the defendants that serve as the basis for this lawsuit. You can't do that. This court said in Mitchell Energy versus Bartlett, you can't do that. And in fact, this is worse than the jury charge in Mitchell versus Bartlett, because the Mitchell versus Bartlett charge, it only said cause in fact. It says related to that you discovered the cause and fact of the injury. That's but for causation. Here, the court is basically saying until you find proximate cause, you find the acts or omissions cause, you're finding actual, you have to know the plaintiff had to be aware of proximate causation before the statute of limitations runs. It's a much worse submission than Mitchell versus Bartlett, but at its worst, it's the same as Mitchell versus Bartlett, and this case has already reversed this identical charge. But there's a second problem, and that's what Justice Gabriel points out. That's that they tie it to the that serves as the basis for this lawsuit. You can't do that. The defendant's issue didn't do that. That no plaintiff would ever be barred by the statute of limitations if they got to come in and said, oh, we're not suing for the first time. We're not suing for the second or the third. We're only suing for the last 2 years. In a Med-Mal case, you could say, we're not, all that bad negligence that happened in the past, we're not suing for any of that. But it was continuing. We're just suing for the last part of that therapy. You can't do that. You can't tie it to the case. That statute of limitations applies when you are aware, not the cause of the injury, but you are aware of the injury in fact, and that's what Mitchell Energy versus Bartlett says. As to the water code violations, it's significant that Appellee's counsel is referring to the dissent. There's a reason for that. The dissent was the loser in that Mitchell versus Blomdale case. The reality is that case was right on point. It said the water code doesn't apply when it has been reduced into trenches. Here, you have to keep in mind, we spent tons of money hiring engineers and professionals to try to reduce water levels down to pre-development levels. We went out of our way to not have an impact. Now, it didn't work. Those professionals, there were issues with that design, there were issues with the construction, but we didn't do any of that. And so the point is, water code is a strict violation when you go out and you intentionally try to divert water and increase the water on your neighbor's property. That's what it's there for. And that Blomdale case is right on point. It said it's not intended when you're reducing it to pipes and trying to limit it. Even if you're the one that did it, it's no longer diffuse surface water, therefore it doesn't apply. The fact that they point to the upper and lower estates, that's a distinction without a difference. None of those cases tie anything to upper and lower estates. What I said, and they happily misconstrued my argument to this court, I didn't say that no cases had ever upheld the water code violation. I said no cases had ever upheld a water code violation in circumstances where you reduced it into pipes to try to limit and control it. It has always been when the defendant went out of his way to try to push water onto the plaintiff's property. That's where it's been upheld. It's important to look at these other causes, the last issue on all the nuisance and the all of those. No expert said my client did anything wrong. In fact, the plaintiff's expert, along with all the others, said, in fact, we didn't do anything wrong. It was the engineers, it was the architects that had the problem. It was simply our problem. For these reasons, we ask that the court either overturn and reverse and render on the statute of limitations, or at worst, with respect to Justice Gabriel's issue, to reverse and remand for a new trial.
All right, thank you, Mr. Reimer. Thank you, Mr. Martin and Mr. Moses. We appreciate all your arguments and all of your briefing, of course, in this matter. And your case is now submitted. You all are excused. All right, we'll call our second case.